It's Central Time. I'm Jay Carlisle-Larson in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us today. Coming up, we talk with a Wisconsin author about his latest novel and what else he's been up to during the pandemic. First, bipartisan calls to investigate the Biden administration's chaotic exit from Afghanistan are growing. At least four committees in Congress have been announced and plan to investigate or hold hearings into what went wrong, each of them led by Democrats, Biden's own party. It's the week in Washington. We'll talk about that and more. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of how the Biden administration handled the exit from Afghanistan? Do you want to see Congress investigate what went wrong? Do you think someone from the administration should be held accountable for what we've seen over the last week? Call in now, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. Reed Wilson is with us now. He is a national correspondent at The Hill. Reed, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right, so let's start with a clip of Democratic Representative Seth Moulton. He's a former Marine and represents Massachusetts in Congress. Here's what he had to say about Afghanistan yesterday on MSNBC.
The best thing that Joe Biden can do right now for his politics is rectify the operation in Afghanistan, save as many lives as we can, get out of there with our heads held much higher than they are today. End this chaos, get a good plan, admit responsibility, as he started to do yesterday in his speech, for the things that went wrong, but most of all, fix it.
And Representative Moulton is referring to President Biden's address on Tuesday there. Now, Reed, what kind of blowback is the Biden administration getting from Congress on the withdrawal?
Well, from Congress, it's almost universally negative. The Biden administration has not found a lot of allies, even among Democrats, for the results of the pullout. Now, broadly, there is bipartisan consensus that the United States needed to leave Afghanistan, but the way it happened and the rapid deterioration that we've seen over the last week, I think, caught everybody by surprise. And with those four hearings that you mentioned are going to get contentious and nasty. It struck me just how few members of Congress were willing to come to the defense of a president, even though his own party is in the majority. And even though, you know, again, as I say, both sides were in favor of getting our troops out of Afghanistan. Remember, this is a process that started under President Trump.
Now, you said that there was almost close to universal consensus within Congress that how this went down was not good. And as you said, it's rare that you don't hear at least a few members of Congress, especially from the president's own party, come to their defense. How significant is that?
Well, I'm not sure right now, because my answer was going to be different to your first question if you hadn't added the words "in Congress." I'm not certain how much the American public is going to pay attention to this in the long run. Some of the really excellent analyses that I've read over the last couple of weeks have pointed to the fact that after the American withdrawal from Vietnam, you know, President Ford didn't face a lot of blowback in the following election there. As a matter of fact, his approval rating went up. Americans were basically done with the war in Afghanistan. This is, you know, it's been going on for 20 years. There was almost no support for staying in the long run, even if that's what was required to maintain stability in the country. And, you know, we've spent billions of dollars. The last three presidents have all promised to get out of Afghanistan. Two of them didn't do so. The third one now has. We'll see if voters reward that or criticize that or even remember in a year. I mean, I feel like the average American had virtually no interest in Afghanistan up until just the last couple of weeks. It sort of became America's forgotten war, even as it was America's longest war.
Now, sticking with that, I mean, the politics were a little bit different between the Vietnam War, which was deeply unpopular, and as you mentioned, the Afghanistan War, which was largely forgotten. You know, do you think that we could see, I mean, historically, I mean, I know you don't have a crystal ball, but how do you think we'll look back at this?
well, how will we look back at the war? We'll look back at the war as a massive failure of American foreign policy, a failure that has extended over four presidents, one in which America was routinely distracted, even as American service members were dying. We lost more than 2,400 service members. Thousands more were injured in Afghanistan. Thousands more contractors, you know, American citizens who were working for the U.S. government in various capacities, lost their lives in Afghanistan. This will go down as a failure on par with the Vietnam War, even if the death count was only a fraction of what happened in Vietnam. But you know, the question is, was this thing winnable in the first place? And there are oral histories taken by the Defense Department that suggest that the U.S. military knew that it wasn't. That this is Afghanistan is the graveyard where empires go to die, or at least go to fail in big military missions, whether it's Russia, whether it's the British, and now us.
We are talking to Reed Wilson right now, national correspondent at The Hill, and we are talking about the political response to what we've seen unfold in Afghanistan after the Biden administration withdrew troops from that country. And let's go now to kind of those political ramifications. What do you expect to see, you know, as, you know, the weeks kind of play out, maybe from Republicans here? We've heard that the Democrats aren't happy. What are we hearing from Republicans?
Well, we're hearing from Republicans a sort of revisionist history here. They are arguing that this was a winnable war, that the Biden administration has screwed up what was a path to victory. And I don't think that was the case. I mean, the Trump administration is the administration that started this dialogue with the Taliban, that began agreeing to release Taliban prisoners, including some of the new senior officials in the Taliban government. And Republicans who have been most vocal about this are, I think, the Republicans who opposed sort of the concept of what the Trump administration was doing as well. We're going to see sort of a new birth of the hawkish Republican right, if you will, a group that Donald Trump did not belong to by any stretch. You've started to see people like Liz Cheney and Congressman Adam Kinzinger from Illinois talk about the failure of the Trump-Biden approach to Afghanistan. I mean, that phrase alone has really stuck out to me. This is sort of the moment that the neocons get to revitalize themselves, if they can.
Can you talk about the genesis of that phrase, the Trump-Biden approach?
Yeah, I mean, this, again, is a process that began during the Trump administration. President Trump promised to pull the U.S. out of Afghanistan and began sending the signals that the U.S. would leave. That apparently began a series of deals that the Taliban began to strike with local Afghan military units, effectively getting them to lay down their weapons in exchange for, what's the phrase? An amnesty, forgiveness, if you will, if they would give their weapons to the Taliban. This has been a long-term process, right? The Taliban didn't wake up overnight and decide that they were going to retake the country. This has been going on for several years now, even as multiple administrations now have pursued a political outcome, a political solution in negotiations in Doha, Qatar. And the fact is now for lack of a better term, neocon supporters of a war in Afghanistan and opponents of the pullout, whether it happened under Trump or Biden, have now seen their moment to draw a contrast with both. And for somebody like a Liz Cheney, who is already on the never Trump, anti-Trump side, that's a good way to sort of reassert a brand of Republicanism that basically hasn't held office since the Bush administration.
Now, Reed, I want to go to one of our callers right now. We have Mark in Grosse Pointe. Hi, Mark.
Hey, how you doing?
And what did you want to say, Mark?
Thanks so much for taking my call. I 100% agree with your guest. And to lay on top of the Biden-Trump disaster is an excellent way for the GOP to begin walking away from Trump. And, you know, the Josh Hawleys, the Ted Cruzes, the DeSantis can really use that narrative. And I can see that in the midterms, and I actually see it, in 4 years, is that, you know, ads with the narrative going across the ads of the Trump Biden disaster. You take a look at the southern border, and then they lay into, pictures of thousands of people running on the tarmac, people hanging off C-17s, and that will play towards people that were moving towards a Biden center will then begin moving to the right when they see, numbers of people that are going to be reallocated, you know, to our country. The fear mongers are going to, the people that are coming are bomb makers. And, you know, you can just sort of see the ads now. And I'll leave it as that. But your guest is doing a fabulous job of painting out the picture. But Biden needs to have the only off-ramp, and I'll leave it as this, is that he needs to extend the arbitrary line in the sand that has been established and do everything we possibly can to get the folks that helped us and interpreters and all the other folks that helped us outside of Kabul and outside the boundaries with that airport.
Mark, thank you so much for that call. Mark talking about the politics, but also seemingly the moral implications as well. How do you respond to Mark?
It's not up to me to say who's right in that, but I will say there's a growing number of governors, a bipartisan set of governors, from Virginia Governor Ralph Northam to Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds, Utah Governor Spencer Cox, Oregon Governor Kate Brown, who have all said that they would be willing to take a lot of those refugees. As a matter of fact, Governor Tony Evers put out something yesterday saying that refugees who had helped U.S. forces were welcome in Wisconsin. And I think that's going to become a major issue here. There is bipartisan support in Congress for bringing those interpreters, those helpers, those people who have put their lives on the line for the last 20 years to the United States to protect them. And that's one of those credibility issues. And we've heard a lot lately about America's credibility abroad. Staying in a country for 20 years is one measure of credibility, but helping those who put their lives on the line for U.S. forces is another measure of credibility. And I think that's the one that's open to the Biden administration and open to these bipartisan governors who are moving in that direction.
We are talking to Reed Wilson right now, national correspondent at The Hill. He's with us for our weekly look at the top political stories in Washington. And we want to hear from you. We are about to talk about the census. How has the population changed where you live? Have you noticed more people moving in or moving away? Do you want to see the legislature and Governor Evers compromise on new political maps for Wisconsin? Call in now, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And we will continue this conversation and take your calls on the census coming up in just a minute right here on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Right now, we are picking up our look at the top stories in national politics. Reed Wilson stays with us from The Hill. And we're switching gears a little bit to look at the census. And we want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see a nonpartisan approach to redistricting? What do you think a fair redistricting process looks like? And what questions do you have for our guest about what we saw come out of the census? Call in now, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Now, Reed, we are talking about the census now. What did we learn from this recent set of data from the U.S. Census Bureau?
I got to say, it's a pretty hard shift here from Census Bureau stuff from Afghanistan to the Census Bureau. But it's absolutely fascinating. What we saw is an American population that grew more slowly over the last decade than we've seen in basically any decade since the 1930s in the wake of the Great Depression, and a population that's diversifying more quickly than we've ever seen in American history. We're getting vaguely a little bit older, but we're getting remarkably more diverse in every state in the entire country. At the same time, we're also getting more urban and less rural as a nation. Now, that's a trend that shouldn't surprise anybody. That's been happening basically since the beginning of the Republic. And we are seeing a population that is slowly moving south and west. Again, trends that we've seen for basically since the first census in 1790.
And can you talk a little bit about, I know that there has been this talk for a long time that 2040 was going to be the year that the number of, you know, white Americans dropped below the number of non-white Americans. But it looks like we're seeing that happen a little bit faster. Can you talk about some of the circumstances that led to that shift in that demographic specifically?
Sure. The big trend that you're talking about there and the big headline that came out of last week's numbers were that the number of white Americans who live in the United States on April 1st, 2020 was lower than the number of white Americans who live in the United States on April 1st, 2010, a decade ago. That's the first time that the number of non-Hispanic whites has dropped over the course of a decade. And it's for a couple of different reasons. One of the things that has constantly struck me as I've been watching census numbers over the last decade is just how long the fallout has been from the Great Recession that we experienced back in 2007, 8, 9, well, really 8 and 9, even though it ended in 2010, the hangover has basically meant that people have had fewer children over the long run. They have had children later in life, which contributes to that fewer children number. And the people have had less economic opportunity, which is associated with things like having families and sort of advancing through what had been a typical American life in previous generations. Today, there are about 3 million American women of childbearing age who do not have children, who, if they had been members of previous generations, we would have expected them to have children. So that change is happening most among white Americans, and it's for a lot of different reasons. You know, people are delaying having kids for economic reasons. Maybe they don't think they can afford it. Maybe they don't have a partner. They can't find a house, which is something that a lot of people do before they have kids. They just haven't hit those markers. And all of that is the fallout from the Great Recession a decade ago. We've seen population growth slow over the course of the decade. I should stress, by the way, that all of this population decline comes before COVID, because remember, the census count happens on April 1st of 2020, and we'd only lost about 1,000 people to the coronavirus as of April 1st, 2020. So all of this was taking place long before the pandemic even came around.
We're talking to Reed Wilson right now, national correspondent at The Hill, right now about the U.S. Census and the 2020 U.S. Census data. Now, the other thing that comes out of this is the fact that this data is going to be used to redraw maps. How is this process going to get started now that states have these statistics?
Well, it's going to be as messy as possible in a lot of states. And you're seeing that in Wisconsin right now. But in a lot, so every state basically has different rules. But every state will now take this data, which is population data down to the block level, and they will use it to redraw their political boundary lines, whether that's lines for Congress, lines for state legislature. In cities that have city council districts, they'll redraw those lines too, so that everybody has basically equal population. Now, some states give the power to the legislature to draw the lines and the authority to the governor to approve or reject those maps. That's the case in Wisconsin. Other states give the power to an independent commission, or they allow the legislature to draw maps without the input of the governor. But basically, the redistricting process is an inherently partisan exercise. The two sides, regardless of who controls what in various states, will use this to try to give themselves the greatest possible advantage in the course of the next 10 years, because this is the lines under which all of our legislative bodies will be determined. Well, at least legislative bodies that have district lines will be determined over the next 10 years. So it's going to be it's going to be a process that doesn't lead to a lot of people making friends. We've seen that in Wisconsin. Democrats have already sued to try to force a federal court to prepare to draw new district lines in anticipation of the state legislature, which is obviously controlled by Republicans, and the governor, who is obviously a Democrat, not getting along and not finding an answer. And based on the way, you know, the legislative Republicans and Governor Evers have interacted over the last couple of years, you know, the fact that they might not, or the prospect of them not coming to an agreement is, you know, a reasonable conclusion to draw.
Reed, I want to go to one of our callers right now. We have Rose in Menominee Falls. Hi, Rose.
Hi there. I was just at a meeting last night, actually, at a local municipal city council where they were we were requesting that the city council support a fair maps resolution. And of course, there have been proposals made, and the governor has already appointed a fair maps commission. And for the life of me, you just said a few minutes ago that the current process is inherently partisan. We all know that. We've all suffered with that. It doesn't matter if it's the Republican Party or the Democratic Party. What our request is that you take it out of the hands of that whole political game, and at least there's more of a chance for fair maps that would be representative for all people.
Rose, thank you so much for that call. In Wisconsin, we have had this issue about a fair maps commission and whether or not it's going to actually come to fruition. Is there a sort of groundswell for more of these nonpartisan redistricting to kind of level the playing field on a national level?
Well, there has been progress towards more states adopting these independent commissions. But I'll say that at least in a couple of states where they have cropped up, Missouri, Michigan, Virginia, even those independent commissions have been bogged down by partisan arguments. In Missouri, it's so bad that they couldn't agree on a chair of the committee. In Virginia, just yesterday, they met, this bipartisan committee met, and they weren't even able to agree on members of a subcommittee that would deal with various different sets of maps. So the question of fair, if you ask 10 politicians what is a fair map, you're going to get 10 or 12 different answers. So the notion of fair is sort of hard to come by. Who is to say what is fair? Is it a map that guarantees Democrats and Republicans representation in a legislative body? Is it a map that makes every district competitive? I mean, those are two things that can be tension points, sort of with each other. So there is no agreement on what fair actually means in drawing a map. And that's something that, I mean, you'll hear both Democrats and Republicans saying, we want fair maps. But of course, you drill down there and you ask what's fair, and they have very different answers.
Reed, we'll have to leave it there. Wish we had more time, but thank you so much for joining us today. That was Reed Wilson. He's the national correspondent at The Hill, and he joined us for our weekly wrap-up of the top news in national politics. Coming up after the news, Godspeed is the story of three childhood friends, now adults, on the construction project of a lifetime. We'll talk to the Wisconsin author in just a minute. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson in for Rob Ferret. Now, if you were presented with a potentially career-defining opportunity with an unbelievable payoff, you'd take it, right? What if it meant risking mental, emotional, and physical safety for yourself and your two best friends in order to get the job done on time? Not to mention, the employer is just more than a little bit mysterious. That's about where we pick up in a new novel by Wisconsin-based author Nicholas Butler. We want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. Does that synopsis resonate with you at all? What did you learn from making those decisions? How did it turn out? Was it good? Was it bad? We want to hear from you. Call 800-642-1234. Again, that's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. Nicholas is the author of several books, including Shotgun Love Songs and Beneath the Bonfire. His latest, Godspeed, was published at the end of July. Nick, welcome back to Central Time.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
So you were here with us in September, and you were talking about, the books that were getting you through the pandemic. Obviously, books are a big part of your life. You have this new book out, Godspeed, that you started writing before the pandemic. It's now come out during the pandemic. Looking back on this book, how do you feel like you got from A to B?
Well, it's been the strangest 2 years of my life, and I think a lot of other people's lives, to put it mildly. Writing the book was kind of a roller coaster ride. I back in January of 2019, I went for a walk with my wife and I started describing the plot of this book. And she said, yeah, it seems like you're excited. You know, why don't you go for it? And then a few months later, I put out my fourth book, which was called Little Faith. And I was traveling extensively, literally all over the world to promote it, and writing Godspeed anytime I had 5 or 10 minutes of time. So when I got done writing that book, I was just spent. and then we rolled right into a global pandemic. So I'm just kind of looking forward to returning to some semblance of normal, finally.
Yeah. Can you talk, you talked just a second ago about your writing process, but it might feel a little foreign to people that don't write. You know, can you talk a little bit about not only your process, but, you know, how it makes you feel in the moment and when you're done?
Yeah. Well, we have two small kids. So to be honest with you, I've never, well, up until the years before the pandemic, I never really had a process. You know, it was about getting the kids ready to go to school and picking kids up from school and making dinner and doing laundry and trying to squeeze some writing in around those things. I guess in 2017, I finally found a process. I would go to Shift Cafe in Eau Claire and write for about 5 or 6 hours. And I felt like I really found a nice routine. A routine that was healthy for me artistically and healthy on a community level, seeing friends and stuff like that. And then, you know, COVID rolled around and all my favorite places closed down. So I'm just sort of looking forward to things kind of hopefully returning to some sense of normal, because I didn't have a great routine when I was here at home trying to educate two small kids who really didn't want to learn from me a whole lot. But yeah, it's a strange job. You know, it's, I've had a lot of crazy jobs in my life, but this one is just really about hanging out with imaginary people all day. So,
let's talk about some of those imaginary people in your new novel, Godspeed. Obviously, without giving away the end of it, but can you talk a little bit about some of these, you know, imaginary people that you spent some time with?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so basically it's about three guys who own kind of a fledgling construction company in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. And they're approached by a mysterious homeowner who wants them to finish construction of what would be like an architectural jewel out there in Jackson. And she wants the catch is that she wants the house finished in a matter of months as they're leading up into a Wyoming winter. And the three guys in the construction company never really understand what's motivating her for that crazy deadline, but they know if they can get it done, they're each of them individually going to receive something on the order of like $250,000 plus all the money that they'll make making the home. So the book kind of functions as a mystery where you're never quite sure what people's motivations are, and information is slowly dispensed, and the reader knows that something bad is going to happen, but they just don't know who it's going to happen to and when it's going to happen.
We are talking to Nicholas Butler right now. He is a Wisconsin-based author. His books include Shotgun Love Songs, and his latest novel is called Godspeed, and that is what we are talking about right now. And you had the kernel, the genesis of this book came from a story your friend told you. Am I correct there?
Yeah, back in 2014, we finished the construction of the house where I'm talking to you from, south of Eau Claire. And a family friend of mine who works in construction came over to talk and look at the house. And he started talking about this other house that he was working on, not so far away from us, south of Eau Claire, multi-million-dollar house. And he said that he and the other guys on the crew had sort of fallen behind whatever perceived timeline the homeowner had. And she got everybody on the crew together and said she would offer each of them a 5-figure bonus if they could get the house finished in the next 3 weeks. And my buddy turned to me and he said, Nick, if we had all the meth in the world, we couldn't have finished that house in 3 weeks. And I thought, whoa, that sounds like an amazing idea for a book. So then I began just kind of asking myself questions about, well, why would somebody have a crazy deadline like that? And where did their money come from? And what would happen if that crew had actually agreed to it? And what would happen if they slipped behind on their deadline and had to resort to using some unsavory resources to stay up all night long to keep working on it to meet their deadline? And at that time, you know, that was back in 2014. I knew it was a good idea, but I couldn't quite see what the setting was. For some reason, I just couldn't see setting the book in Wisconsin. And then we took a family trip out to Yellowstone, came through Jackson Hole, and did some camping in Bridger Teton National Forest near a hot springs. And I was like, this is the place. I think as a writer, you're always trying to figure out ways to sort of increase the stakes, to up the ante. And in the Jackson Hole area, the weather as you approach winter, of course, becomes much more deadly. And also this wealth disparity that we're seeing in America is much more pronounced there than it is, say, in Eau Claire County. And so then, you know, I would just sit in these hot springs and I would think about, well, what if this wasn't publicly owned land? What if this was privately owned? And then I realized where the book needed to be set, and everything opened up for me.
We are talking with Wisconsin author Nicholas Butler right now about his new novel, Godspeed. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for Nicholas, either about his new book or writing? What have you been reading over the last year and a half? We want to hear from you again at 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org, and we will continue this conversation in just a moment right here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Right now, we are picking up our talk with Nicholas Butler, Wisconsin-based author of several books, including his latest novel, Godspeed. And you can join the conversation right now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. Now, Nicholas, just a moment ago, you were talking a little bit about, you know, in this book, there's this crazy time frame that the three main characters need to accomplish to get, you know, all of this money that's kind of being thrown at them by this mysterious homeowner. And one of the things that stuck out to me as I read it was just the push and pull between time and money. And when you think that if you have a lot of money, you can buy more time. Can you talk a little bit about the interplay between that in this book?
Yeah. I just saw some quote. I think I was reading some of Jim Harrison's old essays, and he'd quoted some other writer who said, you know, we trade our lives for money. When I was asking those initial questions about, you know, like, well, what kind of person sets forth this deadline? And why do they have that deadline? And also, how do they value the people that work for them? You know, those were all really interesting questions to me. And also, you know, my wife is trained as an attorney. And for a while, she worked at a very exclusive law firm in Minneapolis. And we sort of had a taste of that lifestyle for a little while, though it was really eating her up. You know, she didn't love the stress of surprise. She didn't love the stress of, you know, meting her life out in 12-minute or 15-minute increments, you know, and constantly thinking about billing. And that really kind of haunted me, the idea that made her so unhappy. But also thinking about a character like Gretchen, who's one of the main characters in Godspeed, who is sort of an early pioneer in corporate law. She's one of the first women to break into her law firm, and just thinking about somebody who's so committed to her work and her craft, but also that way that, you know, some attorneys spend their whole life in a skyscraper, you know, working 15-minute increments at a time and developing a ton of wealth, but then maybe getting to the finish line of their life and just thinking, well, what was that for? That was really fascinating to me. And I think it's part of a grander sort of disease that we have in America where we think, you know, more money or more success or power is somehow the answer to it all. And it rarely is.
Yeah, one of the things I enjoyed reading about Gretchen and this moment stood out to me was when she is in sort of that gilded skyscraper, that she is obsessed with a hawk that keeps flying around and picking up detritus from the city to build a nest. And she keeps trying to catch the hawk with, you know, a piece of steak. She wants to see it, and it just doesn't happen. And that's kind of her impetus to move to a much wilder area, which in this case is Wyoming. Did you see that kind of, and those areas too, as you mentioned earlier, have a really big disparity between those with money and those without. You know, do you think that we're paying a little bit more attention to that now?
Well, I think we definitely are. I mean, I think what we're finally seeing is maybe everyone is paying a little closer attention to it. I mean, we just have, you know, people, normal middle class or lower middle class people that are getting priced out of their hometowns because the real estate market is so bananas. And, you know, you look at a market like Jackson Hole or Santa Fe or Bozeman, Montana, or Boise, Idaho. These are all somewhat wild places, wild landscapes. And now what you're beginning to see is, you know, basically somebody who's like a plutocrat building their house in an otherwise wild area. And what does that mean for our landscape? What does that mean for wild places? What does that mean for our democracy? What does that mean for people that have less money than that? These are super interesting questions, and I'm not really trying to answer them so much as, you know, sort of pick the scab a little bit.
We are talking to Wisconsin-based author Nicholas Butler about his latest novel called Godspeed. And I want to pivot just a little bit to talk about another theme that's at the heart of your story, and that's of friendship, specifically among men. And, you know, it's not unusual for men to have long-lasting and deep friendships, but it's not as common that they're talked about or written about. Can you talk a little bit about this being a central theme to your story as well?
Yeah, it's funny. I don't think anything of that really. I'm not even sure that I totally agree, though I understand the premise of the question. I think it might be true that in literature we don't see a ton of examples of male friendship, but we certainly see it, you know, in cinema. Every cop buddy movie that I saw in the 80s or 90s is predicated on two dudes who are somehow unlikely friends. Or, you know, my daughter often, you know, pokes fun of me because, you know, Lord of the Rings or any other fantasy movie like that is all just a group of guy friends off on some crazy adventure. But I think what I'm interested in is, you know, thoughtful, sensitive, soulful depictions of male friendship where, you know, men in the 21st century aren't just seen as being kind of foolish bros. I absolutely hate the term bro. I think it's just stupid. I think we should ask more of young men than we do. And so, I don't know, I'm just interested in depicting friendships that are sort of like the ones that I'm fortunate enough to have in the real world where, you know, my relationships are predicated on the natural world, music and books, and that's what I try to do in my art as well, I guess.
Well, with that too, you have these three friends that start a business. Can you talk a little bit about why sometimes, especially in your book, eventually those don't really mix?
Well, the fun thing to do when you're writing a book like this is to withhold information. Even when you're friends with somebody for 40 years, you don't know everything about them. And so the three principles of true triangle construction, Cole, Teddy, and Bart, they've been friends forever, but they're all looking at this reward in different ways. And, you know, for example, Cole and Teddy don't know that that Bart is looking at it purely as a way out. He's going to quit the business. His knees are shot. He doesn't want to work construction anymore. And that sort of thing was fun to do, you know, to create these characters who are so intimate, but still don't know everything about each other. And it just adds another stress, you know, within the plot, where people don't quite know everything.
And of course, without giving away the ending, is it safe to call the way that the story ultimately unfolds a thriller?
I hope so. I mean, you know, I was influenced by, when I was writing this book, when I came up with the idea for this book, I was influenced by books like A Simple Plan by Scott Smith and Treasure of the Sierra Madre by B. Traven and Deliverance by James Dickey. You know, I wanted to write a book that was a little bit different than my others, that's a little bit more of a page turner, you know, that could be considered a thriller. But I also wanted to pay, you know, attention to, you know, the molecular level of writing a book, the, you know, writing pretty sentences and stuff like that and getting into character development. So I think of it as a literary thriller. At least I hope that's how people are going to encounter it.
Well, I will definitely say that I spent a good time reading it today during the rest of my prep and a couple of days ago as well, and I found it very engrossing for what that's worth. As someone who loves to read, I want to ask you, what have you been reading recently that has really stood out to you?
Yeah, I just finished a book called The Night Always Comes by Willie Vlotten. He and I were in conversation, virtual conversation at a British book festival, and he started describing his book, and there was, it kind of sounded like our two books were a little bit in conversation with one another. It's about a small family in Portland, Oregon, and they're trying to buy a house to sort of advance their standing in the city and in life. And let's just say that there's some monkey wrenches that are thrown into that plan. And it's a little bit of a ticking clock sort of thriller, a little bit like mine. I love that book. What else have I read? The Ninth Metal by my friend Benjamin Percy came out this summer. Nice literary thriller mystery there. And then I took a trip up to Isle Royale with my wife and son and carried with me a book called Heavier Than Heaven, which was a biography of Kurt Cobain. And really enjoyed the heck out of that book.
Well, Nicholas, thank you so much for those recommendations. And thank you so much for talking to us about your new book today. It's been a whole lot of fun.
Oh, it's been fun for me too. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Nicholas Butler is a rural Wisconsin-based author. I believe he's just south of Eau Claire. We talked with him about his latest novel called Godspeed as well as his pandemic experience so far. And you can catch Nick doing a reading tomorrow night at Northwind Book and Fiber in Spooner and appearing on Saturday at the Untitled Town Book Festival in Green Bay. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, Sam Rogers of Concerned Veterans for America, Wisconsin, joins us to talk about the situation in Afghanistan as the Taliban takes over the government following the withdrawal of U.S. troops. And many people who worked at home over the last year developed new routines to stay safe and healthy. But as many people return to the office, we talked to a doctor about how people can avoid burnout. And many of us do not talk to strangers and would find it really awkward if we did. But a new book explores what could happen if many of us started opening up more and connecting to the people around us. That's all coming up tomorrow on Central Time. And of course, you can keep this conversation going at the Ideas Network Facebook page. And you can always email us at ideas@wpr.org. We always love to hear from you right here on Central Time every afternoon from 3 to 6 p.m. on the Ideas Network. Researchers in Switzerland could set a record for the most precise calculation of pi ever, and of course, Full disclaimer, I want to be clear that I'm talking about the mathematical constant and not the food. Now, pi, if you remember from your high school math class, is the ratio of a circle's circumference to its diameter. And what's cool about it is that it's an irrational number, meaning that it cannot be expressed as a common fraction and has an infinite number of decimal points. Now, to the point of infinite number of decimal places, excuse me, it took a supercomputer 108 days to calculate pi to its first 62.8 trillion decimal places. So while not infinite, still really, really, really long. Now, according to the website Live Science, calculating the precise number of pi isn't super crucial to mathematics, though it is really, really cool. But what it is a really important benchmark to test the computing power of computers. Now, as a special treat for our Central Time listeners, I'm going to read all the digits of pi that the supercomputer calculated. So buckle up. 3.14159265. You know what? I'm totally just kidding. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.